So I don't have any announcements today, so you can just take a brief moment of silence before the service starts. Take a deep breath. Smell the pancakes. So if you have a time machine, you can go back in time about half an hour. There would be pancakes then. Very good. Our speaker today is Reverend Dr. Sarah Olberg. She's a retired UU minister and a fifth-generation Unitarian. She received her D.Min. From Meadville Lombard and served churches in Nebraska and Minnesota. And before that, she was a professor at Yeshiva. I never say that right. University in New York City, New York University, and Buna College in Iowa, which has got its own flavor of pronunciation for what I would normally say, Buena. She has been married to Gerald for 53 years, and they have 4 children, 6 grandchildren, and 1 great-grandchild. So welcome.
Good morning. My goodness. It's kind of like watching a tennis match. For untold centuries, people have drawn apart from the workaday world to worship, to celebrate, and to wonder at things beyond and within themselves. So we are gathered here today to raise our sights and to look at new horizons. Life is more than toil for bread. Life has meaning and purpose. As we celebrate life together, let us seek harmony within ourselves, with one another, and the world, and find our lives uplifted and made whole. Good morning.
At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us. Please stand as you are willing and able and join me in our opening hymn, number 89, Come My Way, My Truth, My Light. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community with a spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Paul Fackler, and I'm the worship associate for this morning's service. As a welcoming congregation, we hope that all visitors, wherever they are on life's journey and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. Whether you are drawn to singular truths, caught in a mind-body or yin-yang duality, whether you are triangulating your position with dialectic reasoning of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, or staunchly supporting things that 3 out of 4 dentists recommend, whether you stand on 5 pillars, weave into the labyrinth of 6 degrees of separation, avidly espouse 7 principles, walk, jog, snowshoe, or bicycle an eightfold path, hold to 10 commandments, revel in an amplifier that goes to 11, or are unabashedly applying a 12-step method, you are welcome here. No matter who you love or what pronouns you use to describe yourself, you are welcome here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service, and while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service includes announcements of upcoming church events, and we look forward to everybody joining in those, visitors, friends, members. Throw yourself in. Please take a moment at this point in the service to hush all your electronics, and we welcome you here this morning. We're so pleased you have chosen to celebrate and worship with us. I invite Susan to come forward now.
Hi, I'm Susan Atkinson. This meeting of the Form and Function Committee will now come to order. I really like this place. I like our colorful plastic windows and our round hallways that my kids feel like they own this place ever since they've spent the night here with their transitions programs. And I like that all of you choose to show up each week. I really like it here. The last and only other time that I have stood up here, I shared something of my long journey to find this church. And now time has made that funny shift where that seems like a couple of years has become just the blink of an eye. So basically, here's how it happened for me at LCUUC. 2.5 years ago, yes, it will be 2.5 years ago this May, I had fallen in love at first sight already with LCUUC, but somehow a couple of months went by before my family and I started making the commitment to ourselves to show up at church. So 2.5 years ago, still awkwardly holding my coffee cup in the social hall after service and wondering if that would ever feel natural. That's how long it is since we've been coming to church here. Like lots of people, I found stuff to do to busy myself while waiting a month of Sundays for feeling natural to happen. Making coffee, doing dishes, signing up for Tai Chi, zhuzhing bulletin boards. I found the paint brushes in the closet. I learned to cut paper and tape it to the wall. Just kind of circulating around and seeing how this place works and starting to think about putting my stamp on it. The next thing I know, I'm on the RE committee, which I highly recommend, by the way. We have the best food and the best meetings. And then through my bulletin board work, I was discovered by the stewardship committee. Little old me, stewardship. Yes, I admit that I succumbed to the charms of Al Haskell. So my approach in all of this was to bring fresh eyes. You know, we're not really from here, and we've just lived here a few years, so. What I saw around me were people who had been at it for 5, 10, and 14 years. They were not tired. They were energized by carrying out a clear vision. They worked with humor and passion. I saw generous hearts making space for each other. I heard stories about how our founding mothers and fathers put pieces in place to handle inevitable conflict, and noted that, indeed, our compassion around here begins with ourselves. I have seen no one turn away from the tasks of living this church. In all corners of this beautiful round building, people of all ages work to build community and the world they want to inhabit. One Sunday, Ginny Corder spoke. She's some big UU bigwig that Jim Hobart brought around to meet us, and I really liked her. She said that in seminary, they're told you basically learn to give one sermon. It's called, What is Saving Your Life Right Now? The day that she stood right here and said that, I realized that for me, this is the place. It's not that my wonderful, privileged life needs saving, you realize. That's not the point. It's that you take the fresh eyes of each day and seize the opportunities around you to express the love you feel for the world. Getting to do that with people that get you, that does save your life every day. And this philosophy works for the whole spectrum of human circumstances, in my and Ginny Corder's estimation, even on the days that your actual life actually does need saving. So, all that happened. Here I am in the blink of an eye later, not having enough time Sunday morning to touch base with all the people that I've come to love. Having more plans for fun stuff to do with you people than there is time in a week or a month. And now my family has made plans to move away from here, back to the South where our roots are and where our families need us. When you put a time limit on something you love, you get to go through that divine process of crystallizing awareness of what really matters. I've known since early fall that it was a possibility that my days around here are numbered, that my husband was going through a brief job search that might land us in some other Kansas on the next adventure. As most of you know, going through such a search feels very, very slow, however, when you live with that uncertainty. My response was to, in the words of a friend here in this room today, to call this the year of yes. If this is my last auction, I want more activity fit into our crazy calendar. We went curling. If this is my last Christmas, let's have an old Bafanapalooza. What a year. It's really been so great. And so this is as far as I have really prepared for this morning because of my extraordinary year of yes. Been too busy to actually finish this here project. So. The only other thought that I hadn't developed just to share with you has something to do with our new friend, Amy Shaw, who the story that I wanted to tell, that just a tidbit from being on the Ministerial Search Committee, is that in our choosing and calling of Amy, you know, she also chose us. And one thing I learned in that process was just that the reputation for this church and the way that we do things has reached out into the larger UU world. And Amy had heard about us, that we are a good group of people to work with. We're not a nightmare for starters, and then it gets better from there. People work hard. All the things that I've lived and I've been describing here, Amy kind of knew about. She didn't know us, but she had heard of our reputation. And all that goes back to the people that put these, you know, this group together, and the people ever since then who have continued to carry it out. You know, so we have a lot to be proud of and a lot to build on. I would like to... Oh, I did scrap something else down. Oh, when you leave a place, you get to tell people what you really think of them. And so that's part of the fun of having a few months. I really love you all, and I'm really, really going to miss you. Thank you so much for all the opportunities to build the world that I want to live in. So now I would like someone please to sign up to help with bulletin boards and perhaps the flowers on the chancel table, arranging some fun and fellowship. Anyone else wants to cut the paper and tape it to the wall, there's going to be space for that. Someone check with Stephanie each week and put your fresh eyes on the newsletter. She appreciates the support. There's probably another room or two or wall somewhere that might need some paint. And I've also got a list of things that I have not gotten around to around here, so check with Phil. Or if you don't want to do any of those things, you know, put your own stamp on it. That's what's so beautiful about this place. Do what you want to do around here. Learn about the church and love it. Thank you.
One of the ways we care for our wider community is by contributing to our local food pantries, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. If you have food items to share, please bring them forward at this point in the service, or ask a child to bring them forward for you, and I invite the children to come up for a story.
Well, we're almost at the end of Black History Month, and I suppose you've heard a lot about people like Martin Luther King. Anybody else? Rosa Parks, good. Uh-huh. Right. Right. Oh, and the Underground Railroad. Good. Have you ever heard of Frederick Douglass? Have you ever heard of Frederick Douglass? Okay. You haven't. Well, you will today. Okay? Do you know what a slave is?
Yes, I know.
Okay, you tell him what a slave is. Sometimes they can be pretty mean. So Frederick Douglass was born a slave. He was born on a tobacco farm in Maryland in 1818, and his mother named him Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. I suppose he named him Washington for a reason. He never knew who his father was, but he did know that he was a white man. He was probably his mother's owner. But soon after he was born, Frederick was taken to live with his grandmother, Pearl Bailey, and he only saw his mother four times after that. He because she died when he was 7 years old. When he was six, he was taken to his master's house and put to work. How many of you are six? Can you imagine having to work all day for somebody else? And he was only allowed to wear a coarse shirt that came down to his knees, nothing else. And he was only given boiled cornmeal mush to eat. And he was often wakened in the night by the cries of other slaves being beaten. Not very nice. When he was eight, he was taken to Baltimore to be a slave to some relatives of his master named the Alds. And think of this, 8 years old, his job was to run errands and to take care of the Alds' baby. And Mrs. Ald, who was a little nicer than a lot of slave owners, began to teach him to read. But then her husband told him, it's against the law to teach slaves how to read. So she had to stop. But Frederick found some poor white boys in the area that he met in the street, and they helped him learn how to read, and he was always interested in reading. When he was 15, he was sent to work for a farmer who was known to break the spirit of young slaves. Frederick worked hard, but even so, the farmer beat him every week. And then one day, Frederick got so mad that he fought back and beat the farmer. That could have been really bad, but the farmer never beat him again. And that's when Frederick learned that you have to stand up for yourself and for your rights. Made a man of him. So on Sundays, they didn't have to work. So Frederick opened a secret Sunday school, and he taught other slaves to read. He longed to be free. He made plans to escape, but somebody told on him, and he was put in jail. Now, again, he could have been killed, or he could have been sent down south to work in the cotton fields, which is the worst kind of work. But instead, he was sent back to Baltimore to the Alds, and he worked in the shipyard. Everything he earned, he had to give to Mr. Ald. And in Baltimore, he met many free African Americans. They weren't all slaves. And one of them he met was named Anna Murray. Well, together all these people planned his escape from slavery, and they gave him the money that he needed. And so he ran, and he made it to New York City. And there he changed his name to Douglas to make it harder for the slave catchers to find him. And he sent for Anna, and they were married. And they moved further north to Massachusetts, and they had five children. Frederick worked unloading barges and ships. And one day he saw a newspaper, and it was a newspaper against slavery. It was called The Liberator. And when he read that, he thought, oh my goodness, other people are concerned about this and helping. And it was just like he was set on fire. And so he arranged to meet the editor of the newspaper, William Lloyd Garrison. And Garrison was so impressed with Frederick that he hired him to travel to other cities and to talk about slavery and how bad it was and to write columns about it and sell the copies of the newspaper. Well, all this traveling around meant that Frederick was in danger of being caught. So he went to England, and there he also gave speeches about the evils of slavery, because he believed that people should not own other people and make them do what they wanted and not have any rights of their own. So, but back in Baltimore, the Alds still had papers saying that they owned him. So he had to get rid of that, and finally some English friends bought those papers, and Frederick was finally free. He moved back to America, to New York and he started his own anti-slavery newspaper. He spoke out against the other kinds of racial prejudice he found in the northern states and for women's rights, because women sometimes in those days didn't have rights either. They couldn't vote. His house became a safe house on the Underground Railroad, and he helped many slaves that way to escape to freedom. And then came the Civil War. And that was a terrible, terrible time. And Frederick organized some men, black men, to fight in the war. And when it was over and the 18th Amendment to the Constitution was passed, slavery was finally outlawed. And when Abraham Lincoln was reelected president, Douglas went to see him. Well, he went to the White House, and they wouldn't let him in because he was a black man. You know about Abraham Lincoln, yeah. Well, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Douglass had helped Abraham Lincoln think a lot about slavery, which is why he decided to do away with it. So Lincoln saw Douglass trying to get in, and he said, "Oh, there's my friend Douglass." And so he got to come in and meet. There's Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. He wrote more books about his life, and he served in some government positions, and then his wife died. And 2 years later, he married this woman, Helen Pitts. But she was white, and a lot of people didn't like that. In those days, blacks and whites were not allowed to marry each other. But Frederick said, "Well, my first wife was black like my mother. Now my second wife is white like my father. So then." During his last years, he continued to speak out against injustice of all kinds. And he became acquainted with a lot of Unitarian ministers in Massachusetts, New York, where he was living. And he traveled around the country a lot, and he helped to finance a Unitarian college in Iowa. Now, most people don't know that at one time there was a Unitarian college in Iowa. It was going to be the Harvard of the West. And Frederick Douglass served on its board of trustees. And he had helped lead the struggle to end slavery. He hoped to see blacks and whites living together in peace, but he never did. He died of a heart attack on February 20th, 1895. And what he was doing when he died was attending a meeting on women's rights, to get women the right to vote. You see, he was working on justice and equality his whole life. And so we have to remember Frederick Douglass as one of the great African Americans as we celebrate Black History Month. Okay?
Can you please help in singing the children to their classrooms? The words are printed in the order of service. Go now in peace. We have been warmed by fires we did not build. We have drunk at wells we did not dig. We acknowledge not only our blessings, but also our many needs. This community exists because we sustain it. The gifts of the congregation will now be gratefully received. Commission. This is a time in our service where we share our joys and concerns. We do this in two ways, by speaking them aloud and by lighting candles. If you have a joy or concern to share, please raise your hand and an usher will bring you a microphone.
My name is Tim Fuller. This would apparently be a candle of joy. After 42 years with the Department of Corrections, I retired Friday.
This is Yvonne. Would you please light a candle of hope? A friend asked me to have that candle lit. She and her family have been in litigation for 8 years over, and their neighborhood have been in the litigation for 8 years with some kind of like a David and Goliath thing against a large organization. And Monday, the final decision will be made. So she asked if you'd light a candle lit. Of hope that things end in a good way.
I'm Jerry. Please light a candle of joy for the Atkinsons and for Al Hassel for organizing a fantastic pancake and very many other things for breakfast this morning.
Hi, this is Dave. If you could please light a candle of concern. Leanne had an aunt pass away, move into the great beyond, succumbing to lung cancer out east. And out west, her mother is finding a need to change her living situation. So I hope that Leanne and her sisters can find a comfortable place for her mom to continue living.
Sparrow, and I brought Robert Collier's cave here to share with the Frederick Douglass and the other people. He was a unitary minister, and he was very prominent during the Civil War and before in the Unity Church in Chicago, and after the Great Fire, about 10 years after that, he went to New York. He was very active in what is now called the Community Church there, I believe, but was at that time the Church of Messiah. So my great-great-grandfather was good friends with him in his later years, and that's how I obtained his cane. And he went through two fires, but his biggest interest was reading books.
And this is Jim. If you would light a candle of joy for Diane McBain's successful surgery and hopefully quick recovery.
And I will light one final candle for the joys and concerns we hold in our hearts.
My reading this morning is from this book, Heretic's Faith, A Vocabulary for Religious Liberals. We have a lot of discussion about using religious words and how we can use them and how we can reinterpret them and what they mean to us and so forth and so on. He does a very good job of deconstructing religious words and helping us to find how we can use them with meaning for us. But at the end, he talks about Unitarian Universalism. Several years ago, at a conference that some of us attended, one of the speakers challenged us by saying that we must be able to share our religion in one sentence. That's all we get because that's all anybody would listen to. Now, if you can't do it in one sentence, you've lost them. This makes it very difficult for Unitarian Universalists who have been accused of never speaking in sentences, but at least in paragraphs. That one sentence doesn't have to explain everything. It's probably better if it doesn't, but it must give a person some sense of what it is that you believe. And it must use words that your listener understands as religious, which is to say, that if you're describing your religion, then you've got to use the language of religion, not physics or philosophy or sociology, anthropology or psychology, not politics, ethics, humanism or paganism. I know that all of these things are important for many of us and have contributed significantly to shaping our religious beliefs, but they must come later and not in the one-sentence description of our religion. This sentence must sound religious to the listener, it must maintain the integrity of our heritage, and it must leave the listener wanting to know more, which is your opportunity to speak in paragraphs. With all of this in mind, for some time I have flirted with a one-sentence definition of our religion. This is it. Ours is a religion whose theology is Unitarian, its faith universalist, its worship creedless, its polity congregational. Theology, faith, worship, and polity. It's these that shape a religious tradition. It's these that people wish to know about when they ask, "What is your religion?" Our theology is Unitarian. We've always been Unitarians. They're as old as religion. Unitarianism is simply a statement about the oneness of God and the unity of experience. But our Unitarian theology and our Universalist faith are integral to our Sunday morning worship, which remains creedless. We have no statements of religious belief, no dogma that are repeated in unison every morning when we gather together. Our religion and worship are creedless for three reasons. First, creedal religion suggests that humankind's spiritual and religious growth have reached a conclusion. Second, ours is a creedless religion and worship since it's something other than creeds that binds us together. It's the relationship with others, not creeds, that hold us together as a congregation. And finally, we place the highest value on the free mind, which means the freedom of religious belief. So, Unitarian in theology, Universalist in faith, creedless in worship, when you understand all of these, it makes sense that the way we organize ourselves is with congregational polity. So there you have it, polity, worship, faith, and theology. If you haven't already, perhaps soon you'll find yourself in a similar situation, as did one minister. Seated between strangers at a dinner party and caught off guard, he lets the cat slip out. "You're a what?" "A Unitarian Universalist." "Oh, I see," the man says, but obviously he doesn't. He's rescued by the women to his right. "I've never really understood just what it is you Unitarians believe. You are Christians, aren't you?" "Well, not exactly. I mean, we were and some of us still are, but most of us are not." "You don't believe in Jesus?" "Not in an orthodox way, certainly. Many of us value his teaching, but few of any of us believe that he was resurrected on the third day or that he was God." "What about immortality?" Well, I guess you'd have to say we're pretty much divided on that one. But at least you all believe in God, interrupts the man across the table. Not exactly. Many of us do, if each in his or her own way. Others of us do not find the concept of God a useful one. What then do you believe? The bewildered hostess politely asks. So how will you answer? Go ahead and try it. One sentence, 17 words. Ours is a religion whose theology is Unitarian, its faith universalist, its worship creedless, its polity congregational. I'll guarantee you this. The silence that follows will give you plenty of time to plan your next move. Let us join now together in a time of meditation, spoken at first, and then for a time in the peace that silence brings. As we enter into silence, we remember the many connections that sustain and uplift us through this religious community. We remember those who preceded us, whose contributions built a free faith and this home for its practice. We remember those around us whose continuing care and thought and deed is an ongoing blessing in our lives, keeping the dream of a free religion alive in our time. We remember those who will follow us, the children presently in our care, and those not yet come to light who will inherit the work of our hands and hearts. In the silence now, we sit surrounded by these many connections, visible and invisible, that remind us every day that we are not alone. Peace be with us and with all under the sun. Now I invite you to join in hymn number 145, As Tranquil Streams.
Thank you.
the very beginning, Unitarians have always agreed on one thing. We were Unitarians, not Trinitarians. Unity, singularity, oneness have ever been the basis of who we are. Our one claim to fame, our religious bedrock, was this: Unitarian, one God at most. A Unitarian historian, Earl Morris Wilbur, in his History of Unitarianism, claims that it was never the intent of the Unitarian movement to substitute one set of dogmas for another. In fact, both Unitarianism and Universalism have religiously avoided any statements which could be construed as creeds or dogma or tests of faith. Over the years, however, both have written statements of belief, from the early Universalist Winchester profession in the 1700s, through the Unitarians' things commonly believed among us in the mid-1800s, up to our present principles and purposes. And many lovely affirmations have been used and discarded. When I was a child, many Unitarian churches recited the affirmation, "We believe in the fatherhood of God, the leadership of Jesus, and the brotherhood of man." That's been long gone for many good reasons, along with other attempts to succinctly state what it is that we are about. So I've been looking over some of these old affirmations, and I found it interesting that whenever someone tried to put our religion into some easily remembered and simple form, it always came out as a triad, a trinity. It's though, having abandoned the belief in the Holy Trinity of most Christian churches, we had to invent and reinvent trinities of our own. So let me give you a few examples. The early Universalists took their trinity from the Bible, from Corinthians, and professed to believe in faith, hope, and charity. And the greatest of these is charity. Universalists were a liberal Christian sect with a strong belief in God and the Bible, and faith was an important tenet in their religion. They believed that a God worth believing in would not condemn humans to eternal punishment, but rather would save everyone. Universal salvation, hence the name. And that all should have faith that this was so. This freed them to stop worrying about salvation and to get on with life in the here and now. They had great hope for humanity. "Give people hell, not hope," said the first Universalist minister in America, John Murray. Universalists believed that things would only get better and there was great hope for the future. But for all of their faith and hope, they did not expect God to do it all. So they practiced charity to assure that a better day would come. Now, consistent with their idea that everyone should work for the greater good, and it was life here on earth that was important, Universalists became very involved in the social gospel and in justice, and they worked hard, much harder than the Unitarians, who were more concerned with individual freedom. They worked hard to improve the human condition. And so they became active in the abolitionist movement, and they worked for suffrage and temperance and many other things. And in the latter part of the 19th century, they adopted a new trinity, or a call to arms: temperance, justice, and wisdom. Temperance meant not only restraint from drinking, but moderation in all aspects of life, a notion we could probably well adopt again in these days of extremes and excesses. Justice spoke to their long commitment to a new and improved social order, coming out of their involvement in abolition, but broadening into other areas where justice was needed. And wisdom. Wisdom meant not only using one's own mind to determine what was real and believable in and important, but to draw from the collective knowledge and experience of people throughout the ages. Universalists had other basic ideals, but the main Universalist tenets were found in these two trinities: faith, hope, and charity; temperance, justice, and wisdom. Now, of course, we're all aware that many of the founders of our nation, including the drafters of the Declaration of Independence, were Unitarians, one Universalist. So it is no surprise that one of the first affirmations of Unitarianism was that sacred trinity, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But these tenets soon had competition. Charles Eliot, the president of Harvard University and a Unitarian minister, suggested a less political, more religious sounding statement, which was liberty, truth, and beauty. This was what Unitarians should strive for: a search for liberty, truth, and beauty in their own lives and in the life of the nation. It was William Ellery Channing and Ralph Waldo Emerson who first suggested reason, freedom, reason, and tolerance as underlying religious principles. And it is these three that Earl Morris Wilbur suggests have been the enduring characteristics of Unitarianism. Wilbur says that freedom, reason, and tolerance are instrumental values, tools, guides, skeletal strength, which underlie our practice of religion. But for all of their endurance as underlying principles, many people feel it's time to take a close look at those concepts to see how well they fit today. Throughout our history, our heroes have fought for freedom. Michael Servetus and Francis David gave their lives for freedom from physical and mental tyranny. Channing and Emerson struggled to be free from a psychically disfiguring Calvinism. And we have long held that perhaps the most basic precept of Unitarianism was freedom of belief, that individuals could formulate their own beliefs based on what made sense to them. It would be very hard to give up freedom as a foundation of our faith. The trouble is that now we sometimes seem to confuse freedom of thought with license in behavior. We have insisted on absolute freedom of the individual with too little regard for the impact on society when everyone can translate the ideal of freedom of belief into a notion that also means we are free to act and believe in any way we wish. Now, some say, oh, you Unitarian Universalists, you can believe whatever you want. We even say that. We believe whatever we want, right? No, I think it's the other way around. It's the fundamentalists who believe what they want, because you would really have to want to believe some of the nonsensical things that they do. We believe what we feel we must because our religion needs to be rational. It needs to make sense to us. Emerson had confidence in the trustworthiness of human nature because he believed in an oversoul or conscience which guided him. He would be shocked at the me generation that puts personal desires before the greater good and sees freedom as an end rather than as a means to enable us to work for that which will benefit the whole. Humanity and the universe. Freedom is not something which releases us from the interdependent web of existence and allows us to go merrily off on our own direction, oblivious to how our actions affect others. No, freedom is what we need in order to be able to contribute to a world of peace, justice, and love. Another good trinity. Unless we can recapture that meaning of freedom, the concept of freedom is in serious question as a fundamental religious principle. Similarly, the word reason has taken on a different meaning than Channing and Emerson had in mind. They did not see reason as only left-brain linear thinking and conclusions that must be supported by empirical evidence. No, to them, reason was using the whole of our abilities, the heart as well as the head, to come to the understandings that would serve us best. They saw it more as collective wisdom rather than nitpicking deconstruction. They would include experience and feelings and emotions and intuition as ways to decide if something were reasonable or not. And in their day, the word tolerance was also a very fine word. It conveyed much more than the sufferance and forbearance, the mere toleration, which the word now conveys. It meant that the truth was much larger than one mind could grasp, and that any human is inevitably prone to error. It affirmed that we could not judge others until we fully understood them, and we could not understand them until we had listened deeply and walked in their shoes. Tolerance was the deepest form of love, a human heart so open that it could look beyond the separations that divide us and embrace all others in the oneness as a human community. On the other hand, some Unitarian Universalists today feel that we've been too tolerant, that we put up too much with some of the more radical beliefs which are harmful to the common good. There's a feeling that we should be more active in calling out and countering such beliefs. Not all beliefs are acceptable, no matter how sincerely felt they are. In the late 1800s, Jenkin Lloyd Jones was field secretary of the Western Unitarian Conference, and a group of dedicated ministers, many of them women, were spreading the liberal word throughout the Midwest. And they formed many churches in the name of Truth, Righteousness, and Love, dubbed the Holy Trinity of Western Unitarianism. These three words captured the basic principles of their religion, envisioned as being broader and more advanced than the elitist Unitarianism of the East. The truth can liberate us all. A righteous life would enable us to become the best that we can be, and love is what binds us all together. What more could a religion need? If truth was the foundation of liberal religion, righteousness was its expression, and love its heart. But if truth, righteousness, and love were the principles of Western Unitarianism, its purposes were freedom, fellowship, and character. It was these principles and purposes that defined religion for my ancestors, who started a Unitarian church in Cherokee, Iowa, and for me growing up in Unitarian churches throughout the Midwest. I have always preferred them, frankly, to freedom, reason, and tolerance. But lately, I've come to realize that even truth, righteousness, and love, however noble and inspiring they might be as religious tenets, also have potential pitfalls. When pursued rigorously, truth and righteousness have a way of turning back on one. It can become easy to believe that the truth one has found is the only truth. And this can lead to the kind of thinking which we now see in the religious right, that what they know to be truth is absolute, and any other version of truth is evil. Similarly, living righteously can seduce one into feeling self-righteous. And again, there's nothing more wrathful than a religious belief that only those who follow one specific path are righteous, and all others are evil. And even love can become a duty, rather than a genuine experiencing of human community. And of course, there's always the danger that we can become too much in love with ourselves. And don't we all struggle with these precepts? I know I do. I've been on my search for truth for so long that I am impatient to make use of all my knowledge and experience, which sometimes means that I expect others to see things the same way I do and to trust my version of truth. I've been known to judge others against my definition of truth and to suffer fools badly, not gladly. And sometimes I can become filled with self-righteousness, not without justification, of course. I am prone to err on the side of action rather than caution. When something is to me obviously right or definitely needs to be done, then I want others to see that and to share my views of sense of urgency. And when that doesn't happen, I can turn critical and speak the truth in love. At least I know it's in love, for I wouldn't bother to criticize someone I didn't care deeply about. There are also some potential problems with the idea of organizing churches around the purposes of freedom, fellowship, and character, as the Western Unitarian Conference did. As we've already seen, freedom, undisciplined and unbridled, can lead to license. There needs to be a balance between individual freedom and the needs of the people as a whole. It seems that freedom, without some powerful corrective, can become destructive. So then what about character? Isn't character the logical corrective to freedom run amok? Isn't it character or conscience that reins in freedom and keeps us in line doing the right thing? Well, maybe. Certainly that's what earlier generations of Unitarians thought. But again, words have taken on different meanings in recent times. Some Unitarian ministers will tell you that character is interpreted by some of their parishioners to mean that they should act strangely, appear weird, and generally be characters. Somehow, the word character has lost its positive emphasis and is now a more pejorative term. Well, at least fellowship. Certainly, many of our congregations were specifically organized as fellowships, and many retain that identity. Of course, now we cannot use the word fellows because it's sexist. But aside from that, the ideal of fellowship, being together with or sharing common interests and values with others, has also gained some negative overtones. For fellowship can mean exclusiveness, that one only congregates with people with whom one feels comfortable, people who look and think and act and live like you. And it is true that some of our small fellowships want to remain small and close-knit with everyone fitting in because they are so similar. We usually call it like-minded. Now, this is not all bad, for we need places where we can feel safe and can explore ideas with others who do think basically like us. But it can also make us appear elitist, racist, and other less honorable things. There's a dilemma. How open can and should we be and still maintain our unique identity and continue to feel that we belong here, that it is our place, that it meets our needs? Arvid Straub, a minister in Durham, North Carolina, thinks that because these foundations of Unitarian Universalism have come to be misinterpreted, we should adopt a new trinity. He suggests commitment, wisdom, and love. He's not alone in suggesting new triads. Reverend Tony Larson of Racine, Parson Larson as we all know him, says our guiding principle should be love, loving our neighbors as ourselves, openness, keeping an open mind and heart, and service, making the world a better place. Notice how our trinities have been changing over time from statements of belief to ways of being. Now, Edward Cahill suggests that every congregation needs to discuss and develop its own fundamental tenets. If it is true, as Cahill suggests, that not only should each church and fellowship redefine itself, but that it is happening, intentionally or not, throughout the association, then what will hold us all together as you use? All of the trinities that I've talked about so far had one basic effect, and that was to give individual churches something to organize around, something to lift up as a kind of a collective belief system, something to hold us all together in a religious association. What holds us together now? Jeffrey Stokes, in an article entitled Unitarian We Stand, says that intentionally or not, we have forsaken freedom, reason, and tolerance and replaced them with interdependence, community, and spirituality. Now, he's not advocating these, but rather he's observing that they better describe what we are doing and talking about in Unitarian Universalist churches today. He reported that at a meeting in the New England UUs about 10 years ago, we took the three great denominational watchwords, freedom, reason, and tolerance, and agreed that these were no longer the hallmarks of our religion. They were gradually being replaced by another three, interdependence, community, and spirituality. Now, I can see where Stokes would get this idea. We talk a great deal these days about spirituality, but it has the problem that everybody defines it differently, and so it does not serve well as a common tenet. It's not something we can together believe in or use as a basis for our actions. Many use it in opposition to the old reason or the search for truth, but it is often too individualistic and ethereal to serve that function. As for interdependence, I kind of like it. More and more, we are realizing that only is no man an island, but we are all so connected, our lives are so interwoven, and we are so intrinsically joined with nature and the cosmos, that if we do not learn to live interdependently, we shall all perish. Perhaps this is the corrective needed to the old freedom, which generally meant individual freedom, not related to the needs of the whole. And community. Yes, I think it might be more inclusive and open than fellowship. It certainly has a nicer ring than tolerance, which has come to mean toleration or merely abiding or putting up with those we don't like or who are different. Community seems to fit with interdependence and sounds warmer and friendlier and more united. Or maybe we should just stop trying to come up with a trinity who defines who we are. We could just take the best meaning from all of the various triads that have been used over the years as we continue to evolve our own. So take your choice. Faith, hope, and charity, liberty, truth, and beauty, temperance, justice, and wisdom, freedom, reason, and tolerance, truth, righteousness, and love, freedom, fellowship, and character, love, openness, and service, commitment, wisdom, and love, interdependence, community, and spirituality, or something else. Think about it. What three words would you choose to tell people what Unitarian Universalism stands for? Maybe love, community, and caring, or commitment, compassion, and connections, or justice, peace, and service. Just think how much fun you can have trying to define what it is that we stand for and what could bind us together as Unitarian Universalists across the country. Or maybe we should just string them all together and add or subtract words as they seem outdated. Perhaps we could find one word that would describe us like the original Unitarian did. That would certainly make things simple. So when we're asked, what is it that you use believe? We could give a direct answer. What word would you choose?
I'm
love to have a polylog at this point. I'm sure all of you are immediately going, what are my three words? What is my one word? What is my 17-word definition? By the way, if you go with the 17-word definition, I'd like you to put it in the form of a haiku, because that is normally 17 syllables. So please come to the social hour afterwards and work on that, but we don't have time to have polylog right now. I'd love to hear some people's views on what the words are they choose. At this point, we're going to extinguish our chalice. We extinguish the flame of the chalice here, that it may glow in our hearts. May it light your path as you leave and guide you on your return. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our closing hymn, number 354, We Laugh, We Cry, and please remain standing for the benediction. Thank you.
think Shelley's done a good job in that hymn of trying to answer what we believe and what our... She died recently. It's a great loss to our denomination. There are several of her hymns in our hymnal. She's a laywoman from Ohio and just a wonderful musician. So may we go forth from this place with joy in our hearts, with kindness in our manner towards ourselves and towards others, with understanding of the past and hope for the future, remembering the beauty and the healing that our own voices and souls have brought us today, and strengthened by that and the spirit that dwells within us and beyond.